We present Tony Hancock, Sidney James, Bill Kerr, Hattie Jakes, and Kenneth Williams in...
Happy Birthday, Hancock. Hello, I'm Andrew Sachs. Welcome to a 75th birthday celebration of the special genius of the lad himself, Tony Hancock. Very few comedians have such an enduring appeal today, and even fewer have a commemorative statue in their hometown. Well, those of us who already know and love Hancock's work won't need to be convinced of his special qualities. So you can just join me as I revisit some of the highlights from his classic radio and TV shows. As for first-time listeners, unfamiliar with the lad from East Cheam's rich comic legacy, well, I envy you. You're in for a rare treat. You're not only going to enjoy some gems, you'll hear about Tony's fruitful but much too short career from some of his contemporaries. And perhaps you'll realise why Hancock was one of the most popular entertainers of his generation. Much more than a comedian, he was a comic actor in a class of his own.
One of the things that Tony had was, of course, that people loved him. What I mean is they forgave him his failures. If he did a show that wasn't up just now, that's 1 week, people would say, oh, it wasn't so good this week, but it'll be good next week. You know, they believed in him. They trusted him. They had faith in him. They put their hopes in him.
Dennis Norden.
If we laugh at Dickens, we will laugh at Hancock. If we laugh at Falstaff, we will laugh at Hancock. If we laugh at W.C. Fields, we will laugh at Hancock. And when people who are of this age knew, who saw him when he first came out, when the stuff first came out, what they are remembering as well is their own laughter. And for... a comedian to leave behind that kind of echo of remembered laughter, it's hard to think it's a complete tragedy.
Even now, nearly 40 years after its first transmission, I'm sure the imperishable dialogue from The Blood Donor goes through a generation's minds when they hear the subject mentioned.
Now, this won't hurt. You'll just feel a slight prick on the end of your thumb.
Well, I'll bid you good day, then. Thank you very much. If you want any more, don't hesitate to get in touch with me.
Where are you going?
Have me tea and biscuits.
I thought you came here to give us some of your blood.
Well, you've just had it.
That's just a smear.
It may be just a smear to you, mate, but it's life and death to some poor things.
I've just taken a sample to test.
A sample? How much do you want, then?
Well, a pint, of course.
A pint? Have you gone raving mad? You must be joking.
A pint is a perfectly normal quantity to take.
You don't seriously expect me to believe that? I mean, I came in here in all good faith to help me country. I don't mind giving a reasonable amount, but a pint? That's very nearly an armful. I don't mind that much, but I'm not having it up to here. Sorry, I'm not walking around with an empty arm for anybody. After all, a joke's a joke and all that.
Mr. Hancock, you obviously don't know very much about the workings of the human body. You won't have an empty arm or an empty anything. Blood is circulating all the time. A perfectly normal, healthy individual can give a pint of blood without any ill effects whatsoever. After all, you do have 8 pints of blood, you know.
Now, look, chum, everybody to his own trade, I'll grant you. But if I've got 8 pints, obviously I need 8 pints. And not 7, as I will have by the time you've finished with me. No, I'm sorry. I've been misinformed. I've made a mistake. I'll do something else. I think I'll be a traffic warden.
And can memories of joyless Sunday afternoons ever be the same once you've heard this?
Oh, look! It started raining.
That's all we wanted. You watch, it'll go dark in a minute. We'll have to switch the lights on. I think I'll go to bed.
You've only been up an hour.
That is, by the way, and nothing to do with it. I might just as well be in bed. There's nothing else to do. I wish I hadn't got up now. Your dinner wasn't worth getting up for, I'll tell you that for a start.
Oh, well, I don't know. I ate all mine.
That is neither here nor there. You also ate Bill's and Sid's and mine. I thought my mother was a bad cook, but at least her gravy used to move about.
What is it that gave Tony Hancock's view of life such a strong emotional pull with the British public? It was that they could often see themselves in the sort of situations he faced.
Now then, I've come about this advertisement in last night's paper. Men, are you lonely? Are you unattractive to women?
Yes.
Well, I am. It says here the Mayfair Charm School for Men guarantees I'll be knocking around with starlets and models within a fortnight.
Oh, yes, sir. Our course guarantees to transform lifelong wallflowers into rare and beautiful orchids.
Yes. Yes, I suppose that's one way of putting it. You can be sure that I shall be much sought after by the opposite, if you'll pardon the expression, gender.
Oh! But of course, sir, nothing is impossible for a Mayfair Charm School graduate. You wish to enroll?
By all means, I'd like to start today, if that's possible.
Certainly. We'll just fill out this enrollment form to see which course you are in need of.
Oh, you have more than one course?
Oh, yes, sir. They're graduated. Depending on the type of pupil, we arrange from the Eliza Doolittle transformation course for the complete failures up to the refresher course, which is mainly designed for the returning rubber planter from Malaya type who's got a bit rusty. Don't you worry, sir. We'll soon place you in the right category. Now, if you'll be so kind as to answer these few questions. Name?
Anthony Hancock.
Anthony, age?
30-ish.
Could you be a little more precise?
Early 30s, you know, not quite over the hump.
Have you ever been married?
No.
Engaged?
No.
Regular girlfriends?
No.
Casual girlfriends?
No.
Do you like women?
Yes.
Oh. Do they like you?
No.
Are you at ease with women?
No.
Are they at ease with you?
No.
Are they antagonistic towards you from the start?
Yes.
Now then, can you dance?
No.
Play a musical instrument?
No.
Can you interest women conversationally?
No.
Can you amuse them?
No.
Do they laugh at you?
Yes.
In which way?
In the worst possible way.
Have you any assets that could be developed to their advantage? No. Are you sought out at parties?
No. Sorted out sometimes and then slung out. Well, I reckon it's the Eliza Doolittle, don't you?
There doesn't seem to be much we can seize on, does there?
No, you're going to have to work for your money here.
I'm afraid so.
All right, then.
Right, well, that will be 100 guineas, please.
Oh, dear. Well, I'll post you my cheque for tomorrow morning.
That'll be quite all right, Mr. Hancock.
Some girl's going to pay for this one day.
Hancock trying to become a ladies' man at the Mayfair Charm School. The character he portrayed so well revealed all our human foibles writ large. But how much of the man himself was reflected in the fictional Anthony Aloysius St. John Hancock that we knew? Like so many of the most memorable comic creations, it was sometimes hard to know where real life left off and art took over. Far from coming from East Cheam, Anthony John Hancock was born in Small Heath, Birmingham, on May the 12th, 1924, son of Jack and Lily Hancock. He didn't stay in Birmingham very long. Tony looked back on those days in a 1963 interview.
Now, we moved to Bournemouth when I was about 3 years old, and my family bought a laundry and a pub and a few other strange places.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of developed my interest in show business there, really. This pub that we had in Bournemouth, a lot of pros used to come there, people like the Western Brothers and Clapham and Dwyer, and they used to take me backstage when I was about 6 or 7, and naturally I got very interested in it. Mm-hmm. Was surrounded by this sort of atmosphere, you see.
Jack Hancock, apart from running the pub, was a semi-pro entertainer in the style of an elegant early Terry Thomas with monocle and top hat. Eventually, Jack took over a small hotel. He left its day-to-day running to Lily, which gave him more freedom to entertain. And Jack died when Tony was only 11, but not before helping a budding comic, George Fairweather, get his professional career underway. A few years later, when the young Tony had tried several jobs, including the civil service, to no avail, his mother remembered the favour Jack, her late husband, had done George Fairweather. But then war had broken out, and Tony decided he'd try comedy. George Fairweather recalled it vividly.
He first started when his mother came to see me, asking if I'd give him a chance, when I was running the shows at the
Theatre Royal Bournemouth for the War Services Organisation. I was running troupe shows there two or three nights a week before Ensor got big. I put him on the first night, and he was terrible. So I said, now listen, son, if you want to get on and you want to go into show business, you want to cut the dirt out. He said, well, they're all laughing. I said, if you walked on to 500 soldiers anywhere and said, arseholes, they'll laugh, but that won't make a comic of you.
Strong words. But Hancock obviously took them to heart, as throughout the rest of his career, he never again relied on risque material to get laughs. He would certainly have had to censor his script on June the 6th, 1941. On that date, Tony made his first broadcast in a show called A La Carte from Bristol, where the BBC's variety department had moved from London to escape the Blitz. In those days, of course, radio was strict about the use of blue material. Radio Times billed him as Tony J. Hancock.
I got the first broadcast there with Leslie Bridgemont, actually, when I was about 17. And I got a return date in 8 years later, so I suppose it must have been quite a success, really.
Well, that wasn't much of a clue to the fame that was to come. Tony's real showbiz baptism came after he'd been called up about a year later.
It was a fairly checkered career. I did quite a lot of things. I was in the RAF regiment. What else? I was a wireless operator, failed at 4 words a minute, which is pretty much of a distinction, I think. Pushed coal up in Scotland for about a year and a half and finally went into Gang Show.
Oh, with Ralph Reader?
With Ralph Reader, which was a marvellous experience and really, I suppose, made me into some sort of a professional. There are a lot of people in Gang Show you probably know, like Reg Dixon, for instance, and Peter Sellers.
Oh, yeah.
At the end of the war, of course, Peter and I actually were in charge of the wardrobe at Gang Show. All very smart and very efficient, I might add.
After being demobbed, Hancock, along with many of his ex-serviceman friends, auditioned for the Windmill Theatre just off Piccadilly Circus. Newcomers like Peter Sellers and Michael Bentin and Jimmy Edwards all got their first breaks there. The problem was that the comedy acts didn't have much chance in between the strippers, who were the main attraction. Tony and pianist Derek Scott devised an act doing impressions of a seaside concert party. They passed the audition and were engaged for 5 weeks. As Tony said later, at these rates, no wonder they never closed. The Windmill? Call it the Treadmill. 6 shows a day, 6 days a week. Either you're a comedian after that or you're out. Well, luckily, they were a success with those poker-faced, raincoated audiences. But Hancock's future was to lie with the wireless, at least for the time being. Like most comedians of the day, he appeared on popular variety shows like Workers' Playtime and Variety Bandbox. But it was clear that his strength was in his character, not as a teller of gags. The amazingly successful Educating Archie, with ventriloquist Peter Brough and his rebellious dummy Archie Andrews, gave him his first chance to show this, here using a hardly recognisable voice.
And the next, ladies and gentlemen, if you please. Seats in all parks, absolutely no waiting. Cartoon, newsreel, trailers, food flash and mammoth stage presentation.
Oh, yes, and a film.
Well, Archie, shall we go in?
No, not yet, Ralph. I'm enjoying listening to this.
I said there are seats in all parts, 2 feature films, 12 rounds of boxing, ice show, amateur talent contest, suits cleaned and pressed.
Two one and threes, please.
Yes, sir, certainly, sir. 2 1 and 3s, and you're just in touch. Oh, no. Oh, not again, no. Queuing in all parts, standing at 12 and 9. 3 pound 10s.
Queuing, but there aren't any queues.
Well, don't just stand there, start one.
Just a minute. Didn't you just say that there were seats in all parts?
Sorry, sir, there isn't a seat in the house.
Isn't it rather uncomfortable for your customers?
Well, the kind of customers we get don't know any better. They're used to sitting on the... Get back in line. I saw you trying to dodge to the front of the queue.
But we're the only two here.
That's no excuse. You should have come earlier.
Look, are you sure there's no room?
I just told you the place is jammed to the doors and I'm the only one on duty today.
Well, why aren't you inside?
Well, it's lonely in there.
I don't think you know anything about running a cinema at all.
Oh, don't I? I'll have you know, young man, I was practically born in the cinema.
Oh? What was showing?
Ben-Hur. It was during the chariot race.
Archie, yes. Archie, stop annoying the man when he's trying to do his job. Leave him alone.
Oh, that's all right, sir. I know how excited these youngsters are when they come to my cinema. Yes. They just love to see my double features.
What have you got, two heads?
Yes, I use the other one for banging against the wall.
Flipping kid.
Hancock in Educating Archie from 1951. His catchphrase, flipping kids, made him a national celebrity. It was around this time Tony had a meeting that was to change his whole life. He was appearing in another radio series starring Derek Roy.
We were doing jokes for Derek. And he was doing this series called Happy Go Lucky, which wasn't having the best of fortunes. And after about, I think they were scheduled to do 13, and after show number 10, I think, on the show, everybody had nervous breakdowns. And a young director, producer called Dennis Main Wilson was asked to take it over. You know, he was the only one mad enough to do it. And Dennis decided that Ray and I were going to write the last three scripts. You know, so I want those two boys, you know, big star maker, you know. It was great. And we did. We wrote the last three scripts, except for one segment of this show, which was written by two Australians, which featured a scout troop. And the scoutmaster in the scout troop was Tony Hancock, with Dick Emery, Graham Stark, and Bill Kerr, and Peter Butterworth as his troop. But he was sitting in the stalls all the time at the Paris cinema, you know, saying nothing. The first words he ever said to Ray and I after 3 weeks of being there. On the last show we wrote, I think it was a sketch about the kids at a party. And as we walked up the aisle past him, he said, "Did you write that?" And we said, "Yeah." He said, "Very good." And that was it. That's the very first words.
Alan Simpson, who just begun his writing partnership with Ray Galton.
We had this idea to do a situation comedy with lasting 30 minutes without guest comics, guest instrumentalists, guest singers, which was the tradition at that time. You had guests. Everything was broken up. And so we just said we didn't want funny voices, and it really wouldn't have any jokes in as such. And we put this to Dennis Main Wilson, and he said, "Right, okay." I believe he had trouble, but he didn't tell us about it.
I think in hindsight, apparently the problem was that the first 3 or 4 weeks it didn't do very well in the ratings. And it was, I think we'd been contracted to do 12, and after about 6, they were thinking of taking it off. And then it started picking up.
Alan Simpson and Ray Galton speaking, of course, about the origins of Hancock's Half Hour.
The BBC presents Tony Hancock with Moira Lister, Bill Kerr and Sidney James in Hancock's Half Hour. Yes, this is the first night of the lad's new radio series. Such occasions are usually marked by a small celebration of some sort, but Tony Hancock is really doing it in style. He's going to throw a cocktail and dinner party, so let's go over to Tony's flat in the English Quarter of London's West End, where he and Bill Kerr are making the arrangements.
Hurry up, Kerr. Haven't you finished typing out those invitations yet?
Don't rush me.
Might help if you took the gloves off.
My hands are cold. Anyway, what's wrong with typing in gloves? I like typing in gloves. Lots of people type in gloves.
Not in boxing gloves.
The opening scene from the very first show, broadcast on November the 2nd, 1954, with Bill Kerr and, not yet, you'll note, set in East Cheam. Here's producer Dennis Main Wilson.
What Galton and Simpson did with his gift of Tony was to start writing real, truthful comedy for the first time. truth is coming in to comedy. Reality is coming into comedy. And we examine the human condition in comedy for the first time.
He was a marvelous actor. Marvelous actor. He could read a script for the first time and get it absolutely right. He didn't have to say, what's this or what's that, even if he didn't understand a joke. On many occasions he didn't. He would ask us after the show, and we'd say, why didn't you ask us? But it didn't make any difference to his ability to put that joke over.
In fact, the acting aspect of Hancock's talent had been carefully developed by Dennis Main Wilson, who had used Tony's ability for character work in the series called Star Bill, with material by Galton and Simpson, and that was just before the idea of Hancock's half-hour had been accepted by the powers that be. In a memo dated February the 12th, 1954, Dennis wrote, "The comedy will be purely situation, in which we will try to build Tony as a real-life character in real-life surroundings. There'll be no goon or contrived comedy approach at all." An important aspect of this approach was to give Hancock a repertory company of his own, and the key figure in this, known mainly for his film appearances at the time, was Sid James.
What you must realise, Sidney, is that straight actors do not earn the same money as comedians. It's a completely different line of business.
Then go back to the comedy. You were earning hundreds at that. Get the red nose and the big boots on and get out and earn some loot.
Never. I've finished with professional buffoonery. I'm an actor now. People in this country respect you when you don't get laughs. They tip their hats when they pass you in the street. Morning, sir, they say. Sir. Sir. Ah, what music. I never got called sir when I was a comic, not once. It was always, aye, aye, big feet, hello, mate.
Well, all comics get that. It's because they like you. They're being familiar, friendly. They like to think they're mates of yours. Don't you want people to be matey with you?
No, I don't. I want respect. I want to be aloof. I want to be considered above it all, unattainable. Like all the knights of the theatre. People don't get matey with them. They don't call Sir Michael Redgrave big feet when he walks down the street. People respect him because they got dignity, you see. I want the old touch of the forelock when I'm being driven down the high street in the back of me Landor. I might give him a slight inclination of the head and a few limp hand waves.
Yeah, well, don't be surprised if you get a few limp cabbages, too.
Tony had absolutely instinctive, perfect timing for radio, which is one thing, as you know, I don't have to tell you, and the other one on stage. And then the other medium, television. I think it was absolutely split-second perfect. I've never known anybody time like he did.
Sid James was the greatest compliment one performer can give another. Bill Kerr was another stalwart in Hancock's regular cast.
I was the most privileged Aussie in the world to come over to sunny England and suddenly be found and get my chance there. And when Ray Galton and Alan Simpson and Ray and I and I think Graham Stark, we were wandering through Berkeley Square, I was telling a few jokes, regaling them about stories about Australia, and Ray and Alan said, hey, what about using Bill with Tony? But there it is. I feel so privileged that I was that august team.
You'll never be a gentleman if you live to be 100. It's breeding that counts. Family background.
Well, that's where I've got it. It's breeding you want. Make no mistakes. I'm the kiddie. I'm the boy. I can trace my family all the way back to Rufus Hancock.
Who was he?
My father. I don't think you quite understand what history flows through the veins. You see standing out on me nose here? All the history of old England for 10 centuries embodied in me. Here. I'm entitled to have a coat of arms stenciled on me bike.
I still say you can't carry a title like Sir Anthony Hancock living in these cheap rooms.
I realize that. Naturally, if I were honored, I would change my surroundings. You never saw Hancock Towers, our country home. Beautiful, beautiful. Well, the great sweep of the drive, the woodland on either side, the great majestic building rising out of the valley, the east wing nestling in the shadow of the hills, the turrets and battlements commanding and solid as if defying entrance to the attacking hordes. Oh. And its huge centre tower hewn out of the solid rock of old England.
and the green ivy creeping up to the side and skirting the arrow slits, the great hall, with its marble pillars reaching to the hand-carved mosaic ceiling. I'm entitled to stay there if I want to.
Why don't you?
It fell down.
Hancock in Almost a Gentleman, with delusions of grandeur being nicely deflated by the delectable Hattie Jakes. She took the role of his secretary, Griselda Pugh. The other character best remembered from the team probably had his finest hour in this episode.
H for Hancock calling control tower. Leveling out at 1,800 miles per hour. Everything going to plan. Fine plane, tell the designer Chappie.
Control tower. Control tower to Hancock. We're worried about possible sabotage. The mechanic who was working on your aircraft is missing. Think you should come down. Land immediately. Repeat, land immediately.
Nonsense, she's going beautifully. I don't know a thing about any mechanic. Taking her up to 2,400 miles an hour. Hancock to control tower. Something strange is happening. There's a peculiar knocking sound on the windscreen. Seems to be coming from outside the plane. I'm slowing down to 1,800 miles an hour. We'll slide cockpit open to see what's wrong.
Good evening. It's an awful cold out here. Can I come in?
What's that?
I say it's an awful cold out here. Can I come in?
There's no room. Get off.
Oh, don't be like that. Move over, I'll sit on your lap.
Get your boot off me joystick, feel nice. Who are you?
Me? I'm the mechanic. I was still working on the tower when you took off. Honestly, frightened the life out of me. I mean, I wasn't expecting it. I was just sitting there singing happily to myself, and then next minute, whoosh, I was up here.
Sit still. I can't control the plane with you jumping about.
Well, I'm only trying to get comfortable. All these knobs and levers here sticking in me. Here, what's this one?
Don't touch it!
Oh, it's the ejector seat. Come back. Where are you?
I'm out here sitting on the tail.
Oh, now, stop messing about. No, come back in. It's no use sitting out there sulking. I can't drive the thing.
Well, go into a dive so I can slide down.
All right. I'll try this lever. Hello. You might have told me there was another ejector seat.
All right, well, we're both out here. Now what do we do?
Oh, look, we're going up.
Well, what do you expect when we're both sitting on the tail?
Isn't life funny? In the papers this morning, the Star said it was my lucky day.
If we keep going up at this rate, you'll be able to tell them they're wrong.
Kenneth Williams, of course, in one of the most cherished scenes from Tony's radio shows. Once the series was underway, the fictional address Simpson and Galton dreamt up for Hancock, 23 Railway Cuttings, East Cheam, became almost part of national mythology. And his Homburg hat and coat with its Astrakhan collar, creating a grand but somewhat seedy image, completed Tony's belligerently comic persona. By 1956, the British public were enjoying the show so much that the BBC decided to transfer them to television. Hancock had been on the small screen before, in fact, shortly after TV's post-war resumption, but he'd failed to make his mark as he had on radio. Just before his first BBC television shows, he'd done a series for the fledgling ITV, but without scripts by Galton and Simpson. Even though his old colleague, Eric Sykes, was involved, it wasn't the Hancock the viewing public wanted. Duncan Wood was chosen to produce the new BBC TV series, and the publicity made it clear that it wasn't just a remake of his radio shows. Tony was able to use other facets of his talent.
I think he was a man who had a lot of insight into human behaviour, because he would suddenly do something which you'd recognize, you'd seen other people do, but you'd never realize the comic possibilities of it, and he had. When you went into a close-up on camera, you could see his mind working before he uttered the next sentence, and the laugh would frequently come on the close-up before he said the line, because you could see it running through his mind, this man's a bloody idiot, I mean, no, and I'm going to tell him so, and it was a marvellous, it's a marvellous ability to have.
Duncan Wood. And here's Hancock in full flight on TV auditioning for the Old Vic with Sid and theatre manager Richard Wattis.
Yes, but we don't know your work. I mean, we have a very high standard here.
Ah, well, if that's all that's bothering you, we'll show you something. Give him the funny walk. This kills him.
He doesn't want to see the funny walk. He wants to see some acting.
Oh, well, do the bit I like you doing.
What, the bit I do in front of the mirror?
Yes, you know, Hamlet, when he's on his Todd up there on the roof of Helsinki Castle.
I assume you mean the soliloquy.
Yeah, he can do that as well. Go on, impress him.
Yes, all right. Which shall I do, Charles Norton, Edward Everett Horton, or the Robert Newton?
I think Robert Newton's your best.
Right, his soliloquy from Hamlet. I take it you're familiar with this scene. The work has been performed here occasionally. Yeah. And I don't want to flog myself to death if you don't know what it's all about, you know. Right, we'll take it that the wings are over here. So I make my entrance in here with the parrot on my shoulder and the crutch. Then I go... Just a minute, a parrot and a crutch. I don't recollect a parrot and a crutch in Hamlet. This is my own interpretation of the part. Do you mind? Every actor has his own idea of how Hamlet should be played. And I see it with the parrot on the shoulder and the crutch. That's all there is to it. Give the... Know your work. I mean, we have a very high standard here.
Ah, well, if that's all that's bothering you, we'll show you something. Give him the funny walk. This kills him.
He doesn't want to see the funny walk. He wants to see some acting.
Oh, well, do the bit I like you doing.
What, the bit I do in front of the mirror?
Yes, you know, Hamlet, when he's on his Todd up there on the roof of Helsinki Castle.
I assume you mean the soliloquy.
Yeah, he can do that as well. Go on, impress him.
Yes, all right. Which shall I do, Charles Norton, Edward Everett Horton, or the Robert Newton?
I think Robert Newton's your best.
Right, his soliloquy from Hamlet. I take it you're familiar with this scene. The work has been performed here occasionally. Yeah. And I don't want to flog myself to death if you don't know what it's all about, you know. Right, we'll take it that the wings are over here. So I make the entrance in here with the parrot on my shoulder and the crutch. Then I go... Just a minute, a parrot and a crutch. I don't recollect a parrot and a crutch in Hamlet. This is my own interpretation of the part. Do you mind? Every actor has his own idea of how Hamlet should be played. And I see it with the parrot on the shoulder and the crutch. That's all there is to it. Give the artist a little leeway in his characterization. Yes, but you can't depart completely from the author's conception of the role. Are you arguing with the actor? No, I'm all not. All right. But I enter with the crutch and the parrot. Yeah. Now, put that fag out. Do me a favour. Let's have the lights down a bit, and if you've got any coughing to do, do it now, and let's get it over. Right, we're on then. To be or not to be? That is the question, ha-ha. When it is noble in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, Jim Ladd. Or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end.
His impression of Robert Newton had been part of Tony's stage act for years, and it didn't take much persuasion for him to use it there. By 1959, there'd been six series of Hancock's Half Hour on radio, which achieved an audience of 8 million listeners per episode. He earned 100 guineas per show. For those of you who don't remember, that'd be £105. Tony was by then also a top TV star. He had a chance to prove his versatility as an actor in a television adaptation of Gogol's Government Inspector in 1958. And perhaps it was this experience that made Hancock ask for more realistic situations in Galton and Simpson's scripts. They completed their sixth and last radio series in 1959 and concentrated their energies completely on television. New technology allowed Duncan Wood to shoot the performers in short sequences, more like a feature film than in the early years when everything had been done live or tape with no editing facilities. Tony was lucky to have brought with him one regular from the radio cast, Sid James. Sid, as a veteran film actor, knew all about the sort of reaction shots needed. Tony was to say later on that his own style was essentially comedy in close-up. However, having to learn his lines, unnecessary on radio, wasn't so easy for him.
We'd arrive at 10:30, spend an hour having coffee. We might have a game of snooker, because we rehearsed in this place, And we'd rehearse for a couple of hours. Then we'd go to lunch. And those lunches would last about 2 hours. Then we'd go back and have another game of table tennis. And then do another couple of hours rehearsal. By this time, it'd be about six. And in this youth club, the boys were starting to gather. He'd say, can we go over that one again, Sid? And I'd say, Tony, now it's time I went home. And Duncan would look up, look up to God and say, oh, for heaven's sake, when are we going to get rid of this fellow? Because he'd been playing snooker all day, table tennis. Anyway, we'd get the show together. And then Tony would start with the fit of nerves. And he'd say, I get the feeling we haven't rehearsed this enough this week.
Poor old Sid James was such a tower of strength. Sid was the opposite of Tony. He was one of the quickest studies I've ever met in my life. You flung a script at him, and 2 days later he knew it. And Tony was meanwhile taking 5 days to get to the same pitch Sid had done in two. But we had a lot of fun. Tony used to like to relax at rehearsals. Hence, we used to have snooker sessions and ping pong sessions, and then go back and start on the script again. I don't think he'd ever make a hustler, whereas Sid James is a natural. And ping pong, well, he'd need a bat about 4 foot square to do any good, I think. The only sport he played reasonably well was cricket. He was a good spin bowler. He played in a charity match once, and on the opposite side, it was a sort of celebrity team against a team of professional cricketers, one of whom was Ian Craig, who was at that time captain of Australia and a very brilliant batsman, hailed as the new Bradman and all that kind of thing. And, of course, the crowd had come to see Craig and people like that. And Hancock came on to bowl. I think he had Craig absolutely plumb out with the third ball that he delivered. And the umpire, knowing full well the crowd had come to see Craig, gave him out. And I think it was the best wicket that Tony never took.
And here at Lord's, with half an hour to go to lunch, we've been playing for just over 1.5 hours, and Hancock hasn't yet finished the first over. The Australian score, including 93 no balls, is 422 for no wicket. It's Hancock yet again to McDonald. He moves in, bowls, and this one's beaten McDonald on the sixth bounce, and it's wrapped him on the pad. The umpire's thinking it over, taking his time over his decision, carefully studying the position of McDonald's left leg. This could turn the tide for England if he's given out. The umpire straightens up, turns to Hancock.
I don't know, I wasn't looking.
Sid also had memories of an occasion that showed what a high profile Hancock now had with the British public.
He came to rehearsal one morning and he said, you just won't believe it. You will not believe it. But I have been asked to do face-to-face with John Freeman. So we all said, God, that's marvellous, isn't it? But you won't do it. And he said, no, I won't do it, but it's bloody marvellous. I mean, he's asked me, hasn't he?
Looking back on your first 35 years, jolly straight question, are you happy or not?
I've been very fortunate, I think, and I have everything that anybody could want to make them happy. But, wait a minute, I haven't finished it. I was going to say that The only happiness I could achieve would be to perfect the talent that I have, whatever it may be, however small it may be. That is the whole purpose of it. And that is the whole purpose of what I do.
Some of the newspaper writers who've tried to puzzle out what makes you tick have said that you're the angst man, the anxiety man. Now, have you any notion of what your anxiety is? Do you, in fact, get a kick out of your anxiety?
How do things have anxiety? Would you explain it a bit more?
Well, something appears to me, even at the end of this conversation, to be eating you. You say that your happiness is just ahead of you still. Well, there's something troubling you about the world. I'd like to know what it is.
I wouldn't expect happiness. I don't. I don't think that's possible.
This was a very sad and very serious man. And he had this compulsion
to be a comic, that is to say, to make people laugh. Well, why? And I concluded in the end that although he actually appeared almost exclusively in pretty broad comedy, either sitcom or later in his life, stand-up comedy, he really was a satirist monkey who wanted to make the world, the public, understand what a stupid and horrible place the world was. People nowadays say that he destroyed himself because he sought applause to a degree which wasn't appropriate. I don't think that's true. It wasn't applause he sought. He wanted the public to share the joke with him. He wanted them to understand what it was he was talking about. He wasn't successful at that, and he thus became sadder and sadder. But the reason he wanted to be a comic was because he wanted to expose what he thought was the idiocy of the world.
John Freeman. Quite a few people felt that he gave his guest a hard time, but Hancock didn't think so.
We got on very well together. I'm very friendly with him now. And I went to his home to see it. We recorded it, you see. Mm-hmm. And I went to his home to see it. And some of the papers carried letters from indignant readers. And I felt no embarrassment whatsoever. After all, we know that if you go on a program like that, maybe some of the questions are going to be tough. Well, if so, don't go on the program. They were tough, and but good. And I was very surprised that there was this reaction, and very disappointed for him, because he got the worst of it, you know, of the criticism.
That same year, 1960, Hancock decided to part company with East Cheam and with Sid. Back to Duncan Wood.
We finished Hancock's half hour as is, that is, the liaison with Sid, and then we went to Hancock on his own and junked the Homburg and the Astrakhan collar. Whether we had ever reached the end of the line, I don't know. Tony thought he had, and that was the reason for the breakup of everything, that he wanted to explore some new pastures, and we kept saying to him, sometimes over a quiet beer, you know, Jack Benny's done 30 years on the main facets of meanness, vanity, and age, and violin playing. Are you sure you've exhausted the vein of what you're about? I don't think any of us were completely sure that we had done that. Tony, on the other hand, I think was. I think he wanted to broaden his horizons in every respect. He wanted to develop and, in fact, get away from the accepted Hancock character. He wanted to go into other forms of comedy. I mean, he was an admirer of people like Jacques Tati and things like this. And he really thought, rightly or wrongly, that he and Sid James were becoming a double act, and that was not acceptable to Tony at that stage.
The last series Tony did for BBC TV includes some of his best work, disproving the theory that he had to be with Sid to be funny. The first show with Hancock alone was relocated in Bedsitterland and was virtually a one-man show, a triumph of writing and acting, including Tony's underplayed gift for mime. The second had echoes of his radio days. Here, he plays old Joshua Merriweather in a long-running agricultural soap opera. No, not the Archers, but the Bowmans.
Here are your scripts for Monday evening.
Thanks.
Oh, good, fine. Let's just find out what old Joshua saw outside the Turk's Head, eh?
Thank you very much.
This is good, isn't it? My word, this is rich. Oh, that's nice. Fancy that. This is your daughter for you. Very good. What's this? Joshua falls into the threshing machine?
Yes, I've been meaning to have a word with you about that.
I should think so, too.
He falls into the threshing machine and is rushed off to hospital.
Oh, I see, yes. A nice touch of human interest, yes. Oh, Joshua in hospital, what a good idea. I've got it. I'm on the danger list. Hovering between life and death. 20 million people crying their eyes out. Slowly he pulls through. Courageous old Joshua. Jokes with the doctors. His first day up, chasing the nurses round the ward. Until 6 months later, he emerges triumphant from the hospital, stronger than ever. Oh, it's a must, yes.
Well, not exactly. He dies on Tuesday night.
He died?
Without regaining consciousness.
Have you gone raving mad? Do you seriously imagine the public are going to stand for this? You'll have a howling mob outside Broadcasting House hurling bricks through the windows.
I'm sorry, but the decision has been taken. We're killing you off on Tuesday night.
But you can't kill off the most popular character in the whole programme. It's ridiculous. If you want to economize, have him put to sleep.
You can't get rid of me. I'm not just the dog, you know. I'm the whole farmyard.
Yes, I know, Harold. That's all right. Yes, all right, Harold. Yes. All right, Harold.
Harold!
All right, Harold. We're not getting rid of you. Now, I'm sorry, Mr. Hancock. Not a question of economy. But our audience research has found that the character of Joshua is falling off alarmingly in popularity.
Oh, this is nonsense. I've never been so popular. Look at last year when I proposed to Mrs. W and she turned me down. 332 proposals of marriage in the next post. When I had that cough, 14 gallons of lung syrup turned up. I'm a real person to the listening public. I'm one of the family. They'll go berserk if I snuff it.
I doubt that very much. Miss Beaumont and I are the mainstay of the program.
Well, I'm not standing for it. I should go straight to the top.
Well, my instructions have come from the top.
Oh. Well, it's the scriptwriters. They don't know what they're doing. They're making me far too unsympathetic. Last week, I kicked the dog 3 times.
Well, that was not in the script.
Well, no, but he asked for it. Shoving in guilt.
Sorry, there's nothing more to be said.
Oh, look. I've been in this program for 5 years. I've acted me heart out for you.
Ah, yes, that's another thing. You're acting.
What about my acting?
Well, it's erratic. We never know from show to show what performance to expect next. And what is more, people are beginning to notice your accent.
My accent is perfect. I spent 6 months on a cider farm in Devon getting it right.
It is never the same 2 performances running. Sometimes it's Somerset, sometimes it's Suffolk. Then a bit of Welsh, Birmingham. Last week, I could swear we had a bit of Robert Newton in there. It's just not good enough. And these ridiculous clothes that you're wearing. This is a radio show.
I wear these clothes to get the feeling of the part. Of course, if you're completely ignorant of the Stanislavski School of Acting, I'm obviously wasting my time with this load of tat here.
We don't want method actors in here.
I'm not a method actor. I don't just rush around the studio scratching myself. What do you know about it anyway? You come in here, an ex-sound mixer for Sports Report, and talk to me about acting. It's all very nefarious, sir. I warn you, if things aren't put right over the weekend, I shall not be in on Monday for the coup de grace.
Well, we thought of that possibility. We have an alternative script ready. So you can either go now and die over the weekend or come in on Monday and get an extra day's pay.
I see. That's the way things are shaping, is it? Well, as my landlady is pressing for the rent, I shall be in on Monday for the threshing machine. But you haven't heard the last of this. Good day to you. And if you start yapping around my deathbed, I shall not be too weak to fetch you a powerful blow with me stick. Untutored hams!
Hancock, now at the peak of his popularity, became the first comedian to earn £1,000 a show plus guaranteed repeats from BBC TV. But far from finding things easy, they became harder for him.
Yeah, the biggest change and the biggest crunch came during the rehearsing of The Blood Donor. And he had a car accident one evening and suffered a slight concussion and was allowed 2 days off rehearsals. And then the BBC had the decision to make whether they cancelled the show that week to give him time to learn his lines or to put up what they call idiot boards, which is, you know, teleprompters. And so we had 5 cameras in the studio and each one had a teleprompter underneath, so that because Tony had 2 days off rehearsal, he hadn't had a chance to learn his lines. And he for the first time in his career on television, read the entire part. And he thought that he was now released from the purgatory of having to learn 7,500 words a week. But Tony, as far as I know, from that day on, he never ever learnt another line. He read everything he did.
Tony's comments in a press interview at that time exposed his troubled mind. He said, "Comedy is frustration, boredom, misery, insomnia. All the things people suffer from. And I suffer." In 1959, one of the chief BBC TV executives had written to the assistant head of Light Entertainment, "We must not at any cost let Hancock go. I got the impression that he would not be asking for more money per programme, though he might ask for a guarantee of 5 repeats in every 10 shows. By the time Tony's 7th series went out in 1961, he decided he couldn't work for the BBC again unless he had full control. When he refused to accept the BBC's terms for further shows, an internal memo stated in 1962, "Hancock is a moody perfectionist with a great interest in money and no sense of loyalty to the corporation." Tony felt that his humour should be aimed more at a worldwide audience through the cinema. even though his 1960 film, The Rebel, hadn't been a hit in the USA. He dismissed Gordon and Simpson, who'd been trying to write another film to meet his demands. Frustrated, they stayed with the BBC and achieved further success by creating Steptoe and Son. His next film, written by journalist Philip Oakes and Hancock himself, The Punch and Judy Man, had shades of one of his idols, the great W.C. Fields, but its box office success wasn't helped by his 1963 television series, this time for ITV, with episodes written by several different writers. The public just didn't take to it, because it lacked the magic Gordon and Simpson touch. And the next few years proved disappointing professionally. Hancock made ill-judged TV appearances in variety shows, played cameo roles in films, and staged a desperate one-man show at the Royal Festival Hall. Most of us know the sad end to his story in 1968, when he died from an overdose of vodka and barbiturates in Sydney, Australia, while working on a comeback television series. Sir James had seen Tony shortly before.
I never forget, I was driving down Piccadilly one day, and I saw Tony standing on a traffic island, and he looked quite dreadful, quite dreadful. So I was down Piccadilly, and I tried to pull up and get over and see him. He really looked so miserable and so... Oh, God, I could keep applying the word desperate to Tony, because this is... I got the car parked, and then I stopped, I pulled up, but then he disappeared, and I didn't see him again. That's the last time I saw him.
At his zenith, a third of Britain's population watched Hancock on TV. I think J.B. Priestley got it right when he wrote that Tony was a comedian with a touch of genius who had no enemy but himself. Well, the happy part of this story is that, just like his favourite clowns, W.C. Fields and Laurel and Hardy, Hancock's humour lives on for future generations to appreciate. I'll bet he never imagined for one moment he'd survive on cassette and video, nor that he'd have a statue of himself in Birmingham. What a plot for a Hancock's half hour that would have made. I believe Dennis Norden is spot on with his assessment of such timeless comedy.
I've always had the feeling that there is Hancock without Gordon and Simpson and Hancock with Gordon and Simpson. Hancock with Gordon and Simpson is a giant, one of the great comic characters in English literature, if you like. And though the Hancock without Gordon and Simpson is a comedian. If radio hadn't been invented and Gordon and Simpson had been forced, as it were, submit it in some other media, as Dickens had to, for example, to put it in serial form so that it was published weekly in a newspaper or monthly in a magazine or whatever, it would today be being studied for O-levels, even A-levels, let's say O-levels. I think it was the finest radio comedy writing and television that we have seen.
What windmills would Hancock have been tilting at today? I'll leave you with an extract from another unforgettable show, The Radio Ham. Updated to the World Wide Web on www.co.railwaycuttings.uk, and you'll know what I mean. On behalf of writer Michael Poynton and producer Richard Edis, this is Andrew Sachs saying thanks for listening and happy birthday, Hancock.
Have a nice cold glass of milk before we go back on the air again. Hello, those blue tits have been in my milk bottle again. Look at me gold top. Picked to ribbons it is. Must have beaks like pneumatic drills, some of them. I will not have great feathered heads stuck in the top of my milk bottle. Guzzling the cream. That landlady's fault, she encouraged them. You know, with her coconut shells and bits of bacon rind hanging about all over the place. They've had a go at my farmhouse as well. Look at those great feet marks all over it. Not good enough. Birds have got no right to be in towns. They should stay in the country where they belong. You wait till I find some of them perched up in my television aerial with the beak soaked in milk. I'll shove a few hundred volts up it. That'll make their feet tingle. I don't know. I wish something exciting would happen. Sort of race for life. That's what I want. Oh, boatloads of sailors be calmed on the China seas. Stricken down with yellow jack. A radio operator slumped over his set, calling in a weak voice for help.
And me, the only one who picks up the message. The only one in touch with the stricken victims drifting helplessly in the grips of a monsoon. Inert bodies crumple over half-eaten dinners. Limp arms hanging out of bunks. Cabin doors swinging on their hinges. Every human being aboard in a deep coma, save for the wireless operator, croaking out messages to me, the only man who can save them. Instead of that, all I get is send a tray of bread pudding to Koala Lumpur. Oh, well, let's have a quick go round the dial and see what's going on.
This is the Voice of America broadcasting to the people of Russia. Here follows a discussion on the American way of life.
I shouldn't bother, mate. They seem quite happy.
Car 35. Car 35. Report received drinks being served in Three Kings, Agamemnon Road at 11:15. Investigate, please. Man beating wife in...
Three Kings, Agamemnon Road. That's not bad, 11:15. I should remember that.
Flying doctor calling Wallumbula base. Message to Fraser Station. I'm on my way, Mrs. Fraser. Just wrap him up and don't move him.
That's good, isn't it? Shortwave, 11.5 metres. Just call him up one night and have a chat about my backache.
Mayday, mayday. This is a mayday.
Mayday? What's he talking about? That was weeks ago. This is June.
Mayday, mayday, mayday.
Mayday. Wait a minute, that's a code word, isn't it? It's the code name for those typhoons. No, those are all girls' names, like Alice and Gloria and Elsie. Mayday, mayday, that rings a bell somewhere. Mayday! Emergency distress signal! Help me! Yellowjack. Hello, mayday. Come in, mayday. Are you receiving me, mayday?
Oh, thank God you've answered. I've been calling for over 6 hours. I thought I'd never reach anybody.
Who are you? Where are you located?
Now, listen carefully. I cannot keep on the air much longer. My batteries are almost finished. My radio is damaged, and I can only transmit on this one wavelength.
I understand. Go ahead.
Please keep tuned in on this waveband. You are my only contact with the outside world.
At last, my bread pudding days are over.